First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
The latest on the pandemic in our area and how it's still impacting everything from our schools to our hospitals, a plan to honor City Councilman Tommy Hizzouri, and the Saints plan to play in Duval while the Jags finalize their roster. The story's making headlines this week. Good morning, this is First Coast Connect. I'm Brendan Rivers, sitting in for Melissa Ross. Thank you for listening. And just ahead, all the top stories of the week with our Friday Roundtable. You can listen on the radio or watch our live stream on our Facebook page, WJCT's YouTube page, and WJCT's website. And you can also watch on demand at PBS Jack's Passport. Then later, some other ways to celebrate 904 Day while giving back to the community. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a busy news week, we welcome writer Shelton Hull. Good morning, Shelton.
Good morning.
We also have joining us this morning, Nate Monroe of the Florida Times Union. Hey, Nate, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Brendan.
Also on the line, we have writer Nakisha Williams. Good morning, Nakisha. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Brendan. Good morning, Jacksonville.
And we also have Ben Becker of Action News Jax on the line. Hey, Ben.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thank you all for joining us. We've got a lot to talk about this week, and we'll go to your comments in just a moment. Listeners, you can give us a call at 549-2937. Again, that's 549-2937. You can also email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, or you can go to our Facebook or Twitter pages, and you can comment and submit questions there. But we're going to begin with our top story, which seems to always be the top story these days, COVID-19. That's dominating headlines and, for many of us, our lives here in Northeast Florida and around the state. Just to start out with some numbers here, Florida yesterday reported 21,723 more COVID-19 cases and 1,338 additional deaths to the CDC. That's according to the Miami Herald. All but 38 of the newly reported deaths occurred after August 5th, and about 70% of the newly reported died in the past 2 weeks. The majority of deaths happening during Florida's latest surge in COVID-19 cases have been fueled by the Delta variant. So things are not looking great. I mean, the numbers are improving. They're better, but it's still pretty daunting. Nakisha, how are you looking at this these days?
I think it's just sad and absolutely unnecessary. People don't have to get sick from COVID and they don't have to die. There are 3 safe vaccines available on the market for everyone above the age of 12 who are not immunocompromised otherwise. And the fact that we keep seeing so many people die, including 2 pediatric deaths in Jacksonville this week, including a 21-week-old baby. Like, it's absolutely unnecessary. And as a parent and as a mother, it's scary because you're doing your best. I'm doing my best to protect my children, and other people aren't taking the same precautions. And it's just absolutely scary and unnecessary.
Yeah, and to your point about vaccines, the vaccination rate does seem to be improving here. As of yesterday, we have 11,468,372 eligible Floridians, which is 53.4% of the state's population. They have completed the 2-dose series of either Pfizer or Moderna, or they have completed the Johnson & Johnson single-dose vaccine. That's according to the CDC. So we are starting to improve that rate number. Ben, what are you seeing here, and do you think we can expect to see these rates continue to improve?
Well, you say continue to improve, but it's hard to determine that. Miami Herald did a story this week talking about assessing in their view, suggesting that the state is cooking the books when it comes to the numbers. And all you have to do is look at the numbers that come out every week. When you look at and compare week to week, you'll see, for example, the state could say, hey, there were 200 and some deaths on a given week from COVID. But if you compare it from the previous week, you'll see it could be a 1,300 difference between deaths. And that's because there's a lag time in the reportable amount of deaths each week. So really don't know if it's 200 deaths, 1,300 deaths, and they don't go out of the way to advertise how many people have actually died. So there's a lot of different metrics there. I'll throw out another example. When you look at the report every week, somewhere along the way, it became about Florida residents who have COVID or have died, not about people who live in Florida. So that's another way that it appears the numbers are being artificially deflated. So with the idea that it appears the numbers are better, I'm not so sure.
And to your point, Ben, I mean, there's no real perfect way to report this information. They're collecting this as time goes by, but there does seem to be a lot of evidence that suggests they are not doing the best they could with this information. Nate, what's your take on that?
I mean, the data is definitely a bit of a mess. Ben is right that because of the just vagaries of how the state is reporting not only deaths, but hospitalizations and just case numbers, only doing it on a weekly basis. We don't get the county by county breakdowns we used to get. It's actually been very difficult to get a real time sense of the scale of this current Delta wave, which is really pretty remarkable because this wave, as far as we can tell, is the worst we've had at any point, even before the vaccine, which is just that really just reflects failings on multiple levels. I mean, from the government, from the citizenry. So it's not a great picture, unfortunately.
Yeah. And the thing that really strikes me is as we're suffering through this Delta variant, things seem to be as bad or worse than they've ever been. We seem to be seeing more pushback against moves to prevent the spread. There's more pushback against wearing masks and against being vaccinated. And there's more push for these things like using ivermectin as a treatment for this. Shelton, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, it's very on brand for Florida. You know, this situation began back in March, I believe. And from the start, we had pretty straightforward recommendations about what to do as far as wearing masks, as far as social distancing. Once the vaccine came through, we had three different types of vaccine come through. And the state of Florida and our leaders resisted common sense at every stage of the game. We blocked a lot of the mandates, and we opened things up fairly early, brought people back in. And now with this Delta variant, you know, I mean, Governor DeSantis and us here in Florida, we pretty much own the Delta variant at this point. And we pretty much own whatever variants are going to come through. We made a decision quite some time ago that human life was a secondary concern to, appealing to Fox News and political basis for various leaders. And so now with all due respect to the health professionals and the people that are trying their best, you know, we're kind of asleep at the wheel on top. And, no one, as Floridians, we've lost the right to be trusted or to be relied on or to have our statistics on any level accepted as valid by anyone outside of the state.
And Nikisha, I want to come back to you and a point you made earlier. So two Wolfson Children's Hospital patients, one was just 2 weeks old, are among the latest victims of COVID-19 in the Jacksonville area. And as of yesterday morning, Wolfson reported 19 patients with the virus, including four in intensive care. Hospital's ICU averages 5 to 6 COVID-19 patients. 7 COVID-19 patients have died at the pediatric hospital since the start of the pandemic in March 2020. I think a big part of the narrative up to this point from people who have been resistant to things like masks in schools is that this doesn't affect children. And I mean, these stats, I mean, it might show that children are less susceptible, but they are still getting this virus, and some of them are still suffering really intense issues because of it. So do you think that will perhaps influence these people who have been really resistant to masks and vaccines?
Don't care. They have no empathy. They have no compassion for other people. This is supposed to be a collective effort of the entire country working together to keep each other safe for those who cannot get the vaccine or for those who are immunocompromised. And we haven't seen that since April of last year, the protest against wearing masks, saying that it's against your liberty and your freedom when it's not. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that you cannot wear a mask to cover your face or that's against your liberty or your freedom. It is absolutely ridiculous. And we're putting people's lives and children's lives who cannot protect themselves at risk because you don't want to wear a face covering or you don't want to get a vaccine, but then you want to send thoughts and prayers when somebody's child gets sick or dies. My son had a COVID case in his class. My daughter is 2 months old. This is a very real issue for me, and I'm going to have a very real problem if something happens to my child because there are parents and there are doctors who are signing medical opt-outs and there are politicians who are playing with lives. That is not your job. You are not God. Stop playing God and put in the place of safety precautions that people need to keep ourselves, our families, and our children safe. If you don't want your children to wear a mask or you don't want to wear a mask, you need to stay home. But you don't need to be out and about getting other people's children sick or putting them at risk because you feel like your liberty is being impeded on. We've had liberties impeded on in this country. It's called slavery. We're not there yet. Wearing a mask is not the same. It does not equate. Stop putting people's lives at risk and stop putting people's children at risk because you don't feel like doing something. That is selfishness. And this entire pandemic, this country has shown just how selfish it can be and has dressed it up and masked it and called it liberty. That is false. It is false.
Yeah, I hear your frustration, and I'm sorry that you and any of us have to be put in this situation. Part of me wonders, so as you all probably know, I do a lot of reporting on climate change, and I see a lot of similarities between the narrative around climate change and the narrative around COVID-19. And a lot of it, to me, seems to have a lot to do with misinformation. So a lot of these people are just consuming media that is deliberately, or maybe not deliberately, but it is misleading. And I think these people might, a lot of them might have these honest, strongly held beliefs that just kind of go against the science. And how, as journalists, as writers, how do we combat that? Ben, I'd like to hear your take on this. What role is misinformation playing here? And what can we as members of the media do to fight that?
Misinformation is a very real thing. You can just go on your Facebook timeline and see different articles that, if you're not really versed in what is real and what is not, it is easy to be fooled by it. I mean, I have friends on social media, you know, these are people who are college educated. They are, you know, they have advanced degrees, and they'll post things sometimes that just aren't in tune with reality based on an article. And now I have to private message them and say, hey, you know, 'cause I don't want to blow their spot, but you know, I private message them and say, hey, what you just posted is something from like 3 years ago and it's been debunked. Mm-hmm. So it's so easy to be fooled by this stuff, and you really have to have an eye for it. And I think I have an eye for it. I think a lot of us have an eye for it. And I think it's upon us to show people when there's something that's false to put it out there. So, and let other people know and try to spread that message, because it's not an easy thing. A lot of the stuff sometimes is veiled in a way that it is difficult to discern what's real and what's not.
Yeah. And as you say, a lot of very intelligent people fall for these things. I know there are people in the medical field who are against the COVID-19 vaccine. It's kind of scary when that kind of misinformation reaches people who we tend to look to trust. So a personal thought of mine is I've always felt that this kind of misinformation just proves that we need some sort of media literacy requirement in schools. I've always felt that that would be a good way to combat this kind of issue that we're struggling with. Shelton, I'd love to hear your take on that. Do you think that might be a potential strategy to fight this misinformation that's really plaging us right now?
Well, that'd be a great idea. Only problem is the people who'd be making that test are the people that are in the schools right now. You know, they say that knowledge is power, and lack of knowledge is power too. And I mean, I've been immersed in conspiracy theory since the days of William Cooper and Sherman Skolnick and all this back in like the 80s and 90s. And that stuff compared to what's going on now, there's no comparison. The new conspiracy theories, it's so blatantly false, so easily disproven. We've got the most, you know, we built this machine, this internet thing that's designed to facilitate, you know, passage of information to people all around the world. And one of the primary uses of this machine is just looking up the lies that the United States government tells our people and tells people around the world. This pandemic has demonstrated that despite all of our efforts, all of our technology and all of our resources, the people of the United States are the most gullible human beings on the face of the earth. We are the most easily driven towards violence, the most easily driven towards this senseless pandemic. None of these people that we've lost in this pandemic, all of them should still be alive, or certainly most of them. Everyone that falls from this point going forward is essentially thrown into the fire by the willful ignorance of our citizens, and people treat it like it's cute. You know, so if you see, and mark my words, you see how things are going with this pandemic, watch how badly we are led astray the next time something terrible happens, the next time we have a terrorist attack. We've got the September 11th anniversary coming up next week. You know, if something like that happened now, the American people, you know, we'd be off in Mars. We'd be off in Jupiter. We'd be doing anything that our leaders told us to do. It's very, very sad and shameful what's going on. And it makes me worry about what we're going to face in the next years ahead.
Yeah. And as tragic as September 11th was, the number of people who have died from this pandemic just is exponentially greater than the number of people that died during September 11th. We've got some callers on the line, so let's take our first caller. We've got May on the South Side. How are you doing, May?
Good morning. I'm going to take it off speaker.
Yes, please.
I heard on the 1A show yesterday, so there are 2 points. Real quick, largest school district in the country, 500,000 students, Los Angeles County. They test every single student once a week and get the information out. They have contact tracers, and they have a pretty low rate of infection. Maybe that helps, but in Jacksonville, it would seem appropriate at this point for every hospital every day to publish the sort of dashboard that Baptist and Wolfson's are publishing on Twitter, but they need to include average length of stay and deaths by vaccinated, unvaccinated, adults, children. And this needs to be published on the local news channels because people are not getting the message. I just saw a graph by, I think it's Tom Friedman with the CDC. Florida has the worst death rate of the pandemic this week, according to this graph I just saw put out by Dr. Tom Friedman. So I'll take my comments off the air.
All right,
comments off air.
All right. Thank you very much, Mae. Nate, would you like to field a response to Mae's comments?
I mean, I feel like we talked about the data, already. I mean, it's just not available, and that's a policy decision that the state of Florida has made. And it's one that has come under a lot of criticism by Florida media and by some mostly Democratic lawmakers in the state. That's just kind of the hand we were dealt right now. I do think the point about schools that I think has gotten a little bit lost amid the kind of high stakes fight over masking is that the state, it's not just what DeSantis is doing to block school districts. It's what the state isn't doing to help school districts. Like, there is no reason why the state of Florida could not have made bulk purchases of high quality masks. It didn't have to be N95 masks, could just be high quality masks enough to provide to school districts to give to kids. There's no reason the state could not be doing a tremendous amount more to help schools with testing, with contact tracing. I mean, as the Duval School Board has already said in a few different forums now, the Department of Health ain't getting it done. The resources the Department of Health has, it's just like not working. And there is not an ounce of energy by the state government and by the governor's office to do anything about that.
And Nate, I want to stay with you for a second. So Leon County Circuit Judge John Cooper yesterday released a written ruling that said Governor DeSantis overstepped his constitutional authority in a July 30th executive order that sought to prevent school districts from requiring students to wear masks That's as Duval County Public Schools' mask mandate is scheduled to go into effect Tuesday, despite the threat of state sanctions and funding cuts. And a bunch of other schools are kind of doing their mask mandate in spite of what DeSantis has said. But what has happened to the idea of home rule here?
You know, Tallahassee has been chipping away gradually at the concept of home rule for many years now. And just for listeners who may not be familiar, the concept of home rule is a little bit like what it sounds like, that cities have the autonomy to govern themselves, that local governing units retain independence from the state and have decision-making authority. And traditionally, something like a mask mandate in school districts would have fallen pretty squarely within that understanding. And as Judge Cooper said in his written order, he believes it still does. He still does believe that school districts retain the legal right to make decisions like that. You know, DeSantis has got many motivations for doing what he's doing to, you know, sort of block school districts and have more of a top-down approach to the pandemic. But I don't know that that squares with the law.
And Nikisha, so the Republican Party has traditionally been thought of as the party of home rule. Why do you think that that's changing here in Florida?
Because DeSantis wants to be president in 2024. it really is that simple. It makes absolutely no sense why he would be so gung-ho to, you know, have an executive order banning mask mandates, getting rid of home rule, not allowing individual districts and counties and cities to do what is best for their citizenry, unless he was trying to show himself as some type of leader that can appeal to the Trump MAGA base to get him to the Republican nomination for 2024. We are playing politics with people's lives, and it's shameful. He should be absolutely ashamed of himself. Like, you know, DeSantis sends letters to new parents. I got one. I wonder if he's sending condolences to the parents who are losing their children because of COVID-19, because he doesn't see it necessary that there be a mask mandate, not even at the state level, at the district level. Duval County put in an optional mask mandate for the beginning of the school year. I know at least four children in my son's class opted out because I heard the parents talking about it at orientation. Now we have a mandatory mask mandate, but it's only for 90 days and there can still be a medical opt-out. Why are we opting out of science and common sense when it comes to children's lives? And the fact that we're even having this debate, that we have to continue to have this discussion, just shows that how far our political climate has fallen. The Republican Party used to be considered the party of compassion, the party of doing things for people, even if they were the party of, you know, limited government and you know, less taxes. They were still about family values. That has all been eroded in this pandemic, and it shows. And to do something for one's own ambition, to put the greater good of the state, of counties, of cities, of the nation behind you for once to fulfill your own ambition, it's callous, it's heartless, and it's unimaginable, and people are absolutely suffering and dying because of it.
All right, and it looks like we have a question from on Twitter from Susan. So Ben, I'll let you take this. She asks, is there any word from Dr. Rivkes? Is he stepping down because he wasn't allowed to promote the sort of best policies that we're hearing from other medical experts?
I'm not aware of that at this time. But I want to go back to Nikisha's point. You know, it's funny. It's interesting. The Republican Party has typically been a party of against big government, but in this instance, it's gone the opposite way when it comes to the mask mandate and things like that from Governor DeSantis's office. So I find an interesting dichotomy there when you compare one to the other of how that's evolved itself, and you could pick and choose the reasons why it's gone that way. But it's interesting how we've gone from big government is now a priority in this respect for the governor's office. I also like to point out that's interesting to me that, you know, while we talk about Duval County, the school district, and the mandatory mask mandate that takes effect on Tuesday, as far as I know, that it, the silence has been deafening from the mayor's office, as well as most of city council. I haven't heard anything from them discussing this, talking about it. Do they support it? Are they against it? Do they believe that the Duval County School District should be defunded? Although it would be hundreds of thousands of dollars based on the amount of money that that the leaders of the school district make. I've not heard anything from any of our political leaders as it relates to that, and I'm curious as to why. I know we've tried to reach out in some ways to be able to get comments, and one way or another, we've been unable to get those. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to see if they support or are against the idea of defunding Duval County schools.
Mm. Shelton, why do you think we haven't heard from city leaders? Do you think it might be that they're just kind of afraid of getting caught up in this sort of political war zone that has kind of taken shape around the whole issue of COVID-19?
I don't know. Maybe they're waiting for Satan to come to them in their dreams and tell them what to do. You never know with these people. I mean, I'm a Republican myself, and I'd like to give them all the benefit of the doubt. But what we've seen over this past year, you know, it's not just the political aspect of it. It's like if you have a small grease fire on your stove and you end up burning down an entire city block. It's like the Great Fire of 1901. The way this entire situation is being handled has been handled from top to bottom makes me very concerned about just the fundamental competency of our leaders on the local, state, and national levels. You know, I've got a friend who's a teacher. She's been the first week and a half of school, she was exposed to 9 different students that tested positive for COVID. The schools didn't tell her. She had to find out through back channels from talking to the parents. I have a friend whose child is in school. Their school bus got hit by a car. Yesterday, none of the parents were told that the school bus got hit by a car. Thankfully, they're okay, you know, but that's the way these things are. We have our local leaders, you know, not to cast aspersions on the mayor, seems like a nice guy, but it seems like everyone is taking their cues from the governor, and the governor is taking his cues from some ambiguous concept of what it takes for him to become president. It's insane. It's absurd that he thinks he could be president. It's absurd that anyone thinks he could be president. It's absurd that we even have to like consider such a thing. I mean, this guy's like, he should be tying his pants with a piece of rope. You know, he doesn't deserve Italian leather, not the way he's handling this pandemic.
Okay. All right. We have another caller on the line. We have Rusty from Arlington. Good morning, Rusty.
Good morning. I would like to take a slightly different approach. I'll preface this with I'm 64 years old, so I'm of a different generation, and we were taught different things in school. I think we were taught more comprehensively towards getting good grades and everything other than doing well so we got funding. You know, they didn't teach this way. But I also learned something during that time that as Americans, we have a social contract that we have to agree upon in order to exist peacefully in the democracy. Because we don't tell on our neighbors and spy on our neighbors like Texas wants us to do, and we depend on the police force and our government to run things, we have a social contract, and we should be following the tenets of the Constitution, our local laws, any rules that are put in place and we sign and accept. We have to abide by those rules. Our children being vaccinated, adults being vaccinated, you are un-American in your action if you refuse to mask and refuse to vaccinate because you are violating the social contract which makes our country work under a democracy. And I think I'll leave it at that because I'm just going to get worse as we go along.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Rusty. Nikisha, Rusty makes an interesting point. Do you agree with him?
I do. With a country as big as ours, it's evident that not everyone is going to 100% agree on everything. And so the political spectrum always lives in tension. There's always the tension between the right and the left, but it should be held in some sort of balance where that measure of compromise can exist so that we can all get on with fulfilling our part of the social contract. And we just haven't been doing that because our country has swung radically left and radically right. I mean, there's no one side who doesn't get some of the blame here. But I think as we think about the future and going to your point where you mentioned climate change, we think about the future and what's to come in 10, 20, 30, 50 years from now. This pandemic is nothing like we've ever seen. The virus is nothing like scientists and epidemiologists have ever seen. They're still trying to learn it and understand it. And as they try to learn and understand it, the virus has only evolved and seemingly outsmarted them as if it were a person. That's only going to continue to happen in the future. The same thing with climate change. It's only going to get worse. Fires and drought in the West, flooding and, you know, cities completely washed out in the East. Those things are only going to get worse. And so if you think about having to fulfill the social contract, we need to be doing things together to keep us all safe, not just my house or your coast or my coast. And we're at a point where we can't even agree to disagree. We won't even listen to the other side to hold up our end of the bargain because we're too consumed with yelling and getting our point across and trying to make sure that we're right. There are some things that you just can't argue with. Science is one of them. The fact that the planet is getting hotter is one of them. The fact that more than 500,000 people, approaching 1 million people, are dead from this pandemic is one of them. But who's listening to actually do something to make it better for all of us? And that's the issue that we're having right now.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point there. COVID-19 and climate change are not political issues, no matter what politicians say, no matter how people try to turn them into political issues. They are issues that have to do with science, and science may not be perfect, but it is the best thing we have to understand the world around us. So we need to trust the science on these issues and follow the best advice that's coming from scientists when it comes to climate change and medical professionals when it comes to issues like COVID-19. So let's go back to schools for a minute. So parents of nearly 24 Duval County school children sued the school board yesterday, and they are seeking an emergency injunction to block the district's mask mandate. Ben, have you been following this? Where do you think this is going to go?
Well, based on the way things we've seen from the state right now, when we have judicial decisions already made on this, I wouldn't see where it's going to go anywhere. But then again, I'm not a judge. I just play one on radio show in my car. So I, at this stage of the game, I don't see how it's going to have any success. But then again, crazier things have happened. Everyone has their reasons, and I'm sure these parents have their reasons. But I would believe when we come around Tuesday, there will be a mask mandate in Duval County schools. Mm.
And Nate, I'm curious to hear your take on this lawsuit as well.
Well, I mean, in one sense, the lawsuit is the way that these mandates are supposed to be handled. One of the points that the judge in Tallahassee made in striking down DeSantis's mask mandate ban is that school districts under state law have the right to implement measures like mask mandates when there is a compelling interest at stake. And I think everyone agrees the pandemic is a compelling interest. The school district has to show that that measure is reasonable, that it's narrowly tailored. It doesn't have to show that it's like the best possible measure. It doesn't have to prove that there aren't better things. It doesn't have to prove that everyone agrees that what it's doing works. It just has to prove that it is reasonable. In the legal realm, that's not a super high bar. And so, you know, parents suing the school district over the mask mandate, in one sense, like that's how this is supposed to work. The school district is going to get its chance to demonstrate in court that its mandate is narrowly tailored and reasonable. And I think it can show that. One thing that the Duval County School Board has accurately pointed out to the state is that its mandate does allow for parents to opt out. Now, it's an opt out. You can only attain with a medical waiver, but it is an opt-out. And the state rules are silent on, you know, what that opt-out is supposed to look like. So, I mean, I think that the Duval School Board can show not only that its mandate's reasonable, but that it even complies with DeSantis's rule that, you know, may or may not still be legally valid. So it shouldn't be overly difficult for the school board. And I don't know that this lawsuit does get very much traction, but I did want to make that point that, you know, this is how it is supposed to work.
Shelton, so one thing that's kind of confused me about all this outrage about mask mandates in schools is there have been dress code requirements for years, and we've never heard this much chatter and this much pushback against those. Why is it specifically focused on masks here? Why are people not taking issue with other dress code requirements?
Well, you know, it sort of underscores just the hypocrisy of everything related to our school systems. I mean, let's face it, look here in Duval County, we haven't been doing right by our teachers, by our parents, by our students for years. You know, whether it's proper funding in schools, whether it's giving proper respect and proper pay to the teachers, whether it's getting proper books and curriculum for the students, or, you know, keeping parents informed on situations like this, we drop the ball time and time again. And now faced with a situation that's complex and dangerous and potentially fatal, well, of course, we're going to fail with that too. You know, we had just a few months ago, as you mentioned, dozens of girls thrown out of school, having their bosoms like photoshopped, you know, in some dark corners in the middle of the night. And everyone thought that, a lot of people seem to think that was okay too. Hopefully the courts will rule on the side of reason, you know, to the extent that courts ever do that. But even if they don't, I think that parents and individual schools and individual school districts need to just go ahead and do what they need to do and ignore the threats of the governor. Legal issues aside, Noam Chomsky brought up a good point the other day, which is that the most powerful thing that we as citizens can do right now is social ostracism. You know, if people aren't wearing masks, if they're not getting vaccinated, if they're hyping up these conspiracy theories, just stop talking to them. Stop having your kids play with them, you know? And, you know, the governor is not really, you know, he's opposed to mask mandates, which is, you know, you take a look at him. I wish he had a mask on. I think that the best thing we could do to get Florida Republicans on board with this mask mandate, you know, just lie to them and tell them all that the mask will be made of leather.
We have a comment from Tom McGuire. Tom says, it's amazing to me that Governor DeSantis can be wrong in his every response to every crisis that has emerged and still be considered a front runner in the upcoming Republican presidential primary election. So, COVID is obviously the headline, and it probably will be for months to come, but I know I could use a break. So let's talk about something else for a few minutes. We got about 10 minutes left to chat, you guys. So Jacksonville City Councilman Matt Carlucci has introduced emergency legislation to name the city council's chambers after former Jacksonville mayor and current city councilman Tommy Hazzori, who is in hospice care at home right now after a lung transplant complications from last year. Nikisha, do you think this is going to happen in time for Councilman Hazzori to see this?
I believe in giving people their flowers while they're alive. So if the Jacksonville City Council believes the same thing, then absolutely it will. But considering their silence on so many other issues, it's really up to them.
And Nate, you've been covering politics in Jacksonville for a very long time. What has Tommy Hazzori meant to this city?
I mean, Tommy is, I think, has a sort of hat trick electoral streak that no local politician has matched in more than the half century we've been a consolidated government. You know, he's had he's held the most powerful positions in the city on, you know, obviously having been a former mayor, the city council, the school board, the state legislature. He, as he is quick to remind people in his one term as mayor, he got rid of local toll roads. He got rid of the stench from paper mills that used to kind of be a defining characteristic of the city. I mean, he's had a huge impact. You know, he is, you know, even in a lot of ways, when former Mayor Jake Godbold died last year, that was appropriately treated as the big deal it was. I mean, in some ways, Tommy is still in office. You know, Jake had not been, you know, in elected office in many decades. I mean, Tommy's still there. Tommy's term as council president was, you know, is both close in time to where we are now and also was very eventful. I mean, he was a vocal critic of bringing the RNC here over the summer. He helped lead opposition to the Lot J plan that ultimately didn't pass. I mean, this is a guy who has just been tremendously active in public life and for such a long time. So it's really kind of hard, honestly, to offer up a summation of his legacy, you know, in a quick soundbite, but it's significant.
Yeah. And I think if I remember correctly, one of the things Carlucci said about why he wanted to do this was because, in his view, Tommy Hizori kind of represents one of the big ideals for local politicians, and that's not to buy into the sort of partisan politics that we see play out at the federal level quite frequently. So, Ben, what do you think of that? Do you think Hizori, and I think Carlucci fits into this description as well. These are people who really put the values of the local constituents above everything else.
Well, to Nate's point, it feels like Tommy's had every position except dog catcher in Jacksonville. And, you know, it's just he's had every job. You know, he's kind of the internal optimist. Mm-hmm. I did an interview with him a few years ago. It was the 50th anniversary of consolidation. And I said, Tommy, it looks like there's been promises here that have been broken that were supposed to happen. Here we are 50 years later, and these promises have been broken. He said, no, Ben. No, they just haven't been fulfilled yet.
Hmm.
So now you can look at that and say, hey, he's very optimistic, or you can look at it a different way, but that's Tommy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he has a legacy, and certainly he's impacted a lot of people, and it would be interesting to see how city council moves forward with this plan. If I had a guess, they probably will.
Yeah. Well, I know we are all wishing Tommy Hizori the best. I hope he gets to spend a lot of great time with family. And I know a lot of people here in Jacksonville are thinking of him. But let's move on. Let's talk about the Jags and their stadium. So let's start out with this column that came out of New Orleans that has been causing quite the stir on Twitter. Nate, you're from Louisiana, so maybe you can give us the rundown on what happened here and what's all the uproar about.
Yeah, I'm in a little bit of an awkward position. I'm kind of a Saints fan masquerading as a Jags fan. Yeah, so, I mean, obviously New Orleans was in need of a replacement venue for its home opener. Jacksonville was a pretty obvious choice from the beginning, just given its proximity to New Orleans and it's, you know, it's along the I-10 corridor. A sports columnist for the Times-Picayune wrote a piece that sort of explained the logic behind why the Saints pushed for Jacksonville as a venue. And contained within that explanation were just some pot shots at the city that it was, you know, it was hard for Green Bay fans to get to because of our airport, kind of just making Jacksonville out to seem like a little bit of a backwater. My own sort of response to that was to just say, I think the columnist was being provocative and probably repeating stuff he had been told. I kind of doubt that the Saints had time to play some sort of money ball head games with, in picking the venue. They got much bigger problems to worry about than where they're playing. So, I think Jacksonville fans felt a little bit rightly offended by that.
Yeah. People were definitely upset about it on social media. So Shelton, let's go to you. So Jaguars coach Urban Meyer, I believe, is under investigation now because he admitted that vaccination status was something he considered as he was cutting down the team to the roster limit. Is that correct?
That is that's what I hear. We haven't heard any specifics as far as who may or may not have been cut or traded away. Some people speculated that it might have been Mr. Minshew who sort of inspired the question, but we really don't know. You know, Coach Meyer has he's had some medical issues, so I don't know how immunocompromised he is. We have lots of elderly people in the that go to the games and things like that. I think Urban Meyer's decision is very reasonable, and I give him credit for coming out and being open about it. We have 32 teams in the NFL, and as of yesterday, I believe only two of those 32 teams have their players and staffs fully vaccinated. Given the amount of close personal contact that happens on the football field, we were very lucky that we didn't have more problems with COVID last season. This season, hopefully we can get through without much problems either. But the last thing, the Jaguars need is, to risk like potentially, potentially having to forfeit a game because one guy got people sick because of nonsense he read on the internet. We need to, keep every win that we possibly can because it's going to be a struggle to get to 500 one way or another.
All right. Well, thank you, Shelton. I have let us go a little too long, so I'm afraid we're going to have to skip our lightning round. But thank you so much, Shelton, Nathan, Nakisha, and Ben, for joining us this morning. It's been a pleasure to have all of you with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, so we will be right back in just a moment. Thank you very much for listening. This is WJCT News, 89.9 Jacksonville.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our Summer of Soul series featuring interviews with musicians who perform in the concert documentary Summer of Soul about the 1969 Harlem Cultural Festival. From our archive, we'll hear my interviews with jazz drummer Max Roach and jazz singer Abby Lincoln. Join us.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
In Louisiana, the power's still off. Schools are closed, businesses are shut, and the governor is urging all those who left to stay away.
There's not water in your home, and there's not going to be electricity. Please don't come home before they tell you that it's time.
Roe v. Wade comes under attack in Texas, and the Sackler family settles. More on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And welcome back. I'm Brendan Rivers, filling in for Melissa Ross. You're listening to First Coast Connect here on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Well, tomorrow is September 4th, which is also known locally as 904 Day. And for our final segment to mark the occasion, we're highlighting some local food and beverage companies supporting a local organization that in turn supports the local community. We have on the line with us David Cohen of Manifest Distilling. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Brendan. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. And we also have on the line David Garfunkel of Lift Jacks. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
All right, so let's start out with you, David. Tell us a little bit about Lift Jacks. What is the organization? What do you do?
Lift Jacks is an initiative of business leaders and community leaders with a mission to eradicate generational poverty. We are doing our work first starting in the East Side neighborhood of Jacksonville, implementing a purpose-built communities model, a proven model for community revitalization and the eradication of poverty. that contains four pillars: housing, education, community wellness, and long-term financial vitality. And we've begun the implementation of that model again in Jacksonville's East Side, and really just hitting the ground running.
All right, and David, tell us a little bit about Manifest Distilling.
Yeah, so Manifest is a craft cocktail and distillery downtown Jacksonville. We've been here for almost 5 years, celebrating 5 years in the middle of September, and we're celebrating kicking off our cocktail room, which is given our ability to now sell cocktails due to some recent legislation that passed at the state level this past July. And obviously we're kicking off our charitable contributions with David and Liv Jax.
All right, and so our producer Heather brought in this shot for me. It's some sort of guava drink. Can you tell me about what this is before I try it?
Sure, Ben. Do you want to talk about it? I'm here with Ben, and Ben's heading up our mixology program here. And what we gave to you guys is one of our specialty cocktails on the menu. But Ben, go ahead.
Yeah, so it's a style of cocktail called a milk punch, but it's clarified, so the milk is added in along with acid, and it drops pretty much all your solids to the bottom, completely clarifies it. So, you know, even though there's milk in it, you can't really see anything. It just looks like water.
Yeah.
But there is guava, there is fennel, lime, oolong tea, rum, some of our rum, and some of our gin in there as well.
This is really good. It's a great way to start my morning, I guess.
It's never too early, especially on Friday, right? Good way to kick off 904 weekend.
Yeah, and I also have some bags of Bold Bean coffee here, a great local coffee roaster. So they're involved in this as well. Is that correct, David?
That's right. In addition to Manifest's generous support through the cocktail room, Bold Bean Coffee Roasters has graciously created three limited supply blends, 9, 0, and 4, featuring collectible labels. So they're donating a portion of those proceeds to Lift Jacks as well. So would encourage everyone to stop by Bold Bean, or you can check them out online to pick up those coffees and those collectible labels.
And so the cocktail room at Manifest Distilling, one thing that's jumping out to me here is you guys have live music regularly, and apparently Ulysses Owens Jr. comes out there, who's a friend of mine, phenomenal local musician here in Jacksonville. Can you tell us about what other the music that you guys have and any other kind of events that you're hosting there?
Sure. So in addition to kicking off the cocktail room, which our grand opening is tonight, we're open 2 to midnight tonight, and then during the weeks we'll be open Wednesday through Saturdays and open during any kind of home Jaguars game. But to add some programming, like you just brought up, we worked with Ulysses Owens Jr., who, like you said, is a local musician, super talented dude, and a good friend of mine. And we're instituting Thursday night jazz nights at Manifest. So we're trying to bring kind of the underground jazz vibe back to the east side of downtown. It'll be a free show every Thursday evening, starts around 6 o'clock. Great to come by after work, have a good cocktail, and listen to some killer jazz music.
Yeah, I will definitely have to come check that out. Sounds really fantastic. And so the proceeds through the cocktail room are going to help some good local causes. Is that correct?
That's right. So September also kicks off our charitable giving program. We've been heavily involved over the past 5 years with downtown and with our communities, and now this cocktail room has kind of kicked off the ability for us to formalize what that charitable giving looks like. So our first month, every month, we're going to choose to work with a different charity. This month kicks off with Lift Jacks, where we will donate a portion of all of our sales, retail and bottle sales, out of this tasting room to Lift Jacks for the month.
Okay, and anything else you two want to make sure that our audience knows about 904 Day or what you guys are working on?
I would just highlight that, you know, specifically what we're really excited about in terms of the support for this month is we're using the proceeds from both Manifest and Bold Bean to support our home repair program that we've launched in partnership with LISC Jacksonville and the Historic Eastside Community Development Corporation. We're supporting Eastside homeowners, generational families, and making improvements to their homes, ensuring those families can remain in safe, stable housing. And so we're really excited about that project, and we'll be excited to tell the stories about how this support is contributing to that important work in the Eastside.
Okay. And where can our listeners find more information about your organizations in 904 Day?
So for us, liftjax.org, LIFTJAX. I'll put the plug in for Bold Bean, boldbeancoffee.com. David, over to you.
For Manifest, it's just manifestdistilling.com. You can also find us on social media, and that's kind of where we update for all of our upcoming events.
All right, and another quick question for you, David, because I know people, when they go to bars, a lot of times they're thinking about vibe. What's the vibe? So just tell us a little bit about the cocktail room, what people can expect when they go there.
So the cocktail room is really an extension of our brand, which is this kind of classic, contemporary, upscale vibe. The space looks very similar to the way it did before, but obviously now we've got all of this, you know, this glassware. We've got we had a beautiful bar, and now we've just set it up in a more formal environment. The cocktails that we make match that vibe, and then obviously the music, bringing in, you know, super talented jazz musicians and other great musicians. Like, for example, tonight we're going to have BEZ, the brass band, playing. So all of that kind of fits into that overall vibe.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. That's our program, everyone. Thank you to all of our guests and our callers. Our senior producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Catherine Hobbs is our associate producer. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. And Bill Bortsfield just had his last day as our digital editor yesterday. Thank you for all the work you've done over the years, Bill. We will miss you. If you have questions or comments about First Coast Connect, send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. I'm Brendan Rivers, sitting in for Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. We'll be back on Tuesday due to the Labor Day holiday, but if you missed anything, you can listen to our rebroadcast at 8 p.m. and find today's show at wjct.org and on your favorite podcast platform. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.